Hello, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm joined today by Emery Roan and Mike Keyes. We'll talk about how we might have live streams from the U.S. Supreme Court in the next century. Facebook joins a band. We'll bring you a very brony Hamilton, and Six Strikes rises from the grave just in time for Halloween. All this and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT. This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Matt Curtis. Episode 402, recorded October 6th, 2017. Google wants a spanking. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Welcome to This Week in Law. I'm here with two of my wonderful co-hosts. Mike Keyes is here. He's a partner at the Dorsey Firm in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Mike. Great to see you.
Hello, Denise. Great to see you. Great to have Emery with us today, and great to be back with everybody.
It is wonderful to see you as well. And yes, Emery Roan is here, too. Hey, Emery, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, Denise, thanks for having me. As always, I think I say that every show, but it stands true every time. So, yeah, stoked to be here. Excited to have a great show.
Me too. Emery, for folks who are not familiar with him, is a graduate of California Western Law School in San Diego, California, a waiter of bar results at the moment. How's that going?
I just hate that title. It's the worst title. I can't figure out if it's like well wishes or jinxing me, but
I know it's a difficult time of life.
Results.
I know it's one of those things that hasn't changed since the dark ages when I went to law school, and the slightly less dark ages when Mike went to law school. You still have to wait forever to find out if you passed that horrific test.
An incredibly long amount of time, considering how much the test costs to take. But
yeah,
when do you find out, Emery?
Oh, they release them on Thanksgiving weekend to just maximize any awkward conversations that you might have to have when you go home to see your family. No matter what happens, it will be awful. Thank you, ABA.
At least, yeah, I'm sure you get the results electronically now. I actually had to, because I was going to be with my family for Thanksgiving weekend, I had to tell the bar to mail my bar results to where I would be, or else I would have missed out on getting them when they first came out. So they actually had to physically arrive in the mailbox at my parents' home.
Oh.
It was chilling.
I believe that they have stopped publicly posting the fail list. So that's at least a step up from others.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would not be good. Okay, so we're pulling for you, Emery, all of us here.
Thank you.
This week.
Thank you. I'm optimistic. And yeah, it'll be fine.
I'm sure everyone out in the ether. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk about this week. Let's start out in the realm of crimes and justice. We have a couple of things to follow up on from items that we've discussed previously on the show. So let's get to them first. It was just a few weeks ago that we were talking about asset forfeiture and how that works and the whole concept of being able to seize someone's assets, particularly if they are branded a fugitive, before they've even been tried in the U.S. And this is something that Kim.com of Mega Upload fame has been combating. And unfortunately, Kim.com has now had three shots at this before the U.S. court system and has lost out on all three. The most recent being that the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear Kim.com's case on this issue. they had made what I thought at least were some intriguing arguments over the fact that it's difficult to label someone a fugitive and seize their assets when they've never even been to the country. I have a hard time wrapping my head around how you can be a fugitive from a country if you've never been to the country. But the courts don't seem to have any problem wrapping their heads around that because obviously he has committed crimes in the country, and that seems to be enough for them. The Supreme Court, by declining to hear the case, hasn't ruled anything substantively on the issue. It has just decided it is not going to undo what happened at the appellate level below it. And what that now means is that according to U.S. courts anyway, it is perfectly okay for prosecutors to seize Kim.com's assets in specifically New Zealand and Hong Kong. And those are two places where Kim.com's lawyers will proceed next to have them weigh in on the issue and see if it's okay under their judicial systems for these assets to be seized. Any thoughts on this, Emery?
No, I actually don't have any thoughts. I mean, the issue of civil forfeiture is problematic, to say the least, and certainly a huge issue in the criminal justice system. But I don't know enough of the specific details of this case to really have anything more than what you just said. Kim.com is not an easy person to sympathize with, but you know, I think here it's a pretty insane. It sounds certainly pretty incredible.
There's this concept that I remember that you probably remember much better. We were just talking about you having just taken the bar from criminal procedure and the criminal procedure sections of the bar and law school. That has to do with, it's called double jeopardy. Which is a concept under U.S. law where it's basically an equitable kind of doctrine that says if you're going to get punished once for something, you can't get punished again for the same thing. And that's sort of a broad sweeping statement. And we know that there are, you know, sentences in our country that involve people having jail terms long past their reasonable lifespan. And so I don't know how that really jibes with double jeopardy. But that it seems to be the principle that's being argued by Kim.com's lawyers here, is that by seizing all the assets before he's even been tried in the U.S., there's right. really nothing more to punish him for once that's, you know, if he's tried and found guilty, then what do? You seize all his assets. Well, that's already been done. So any criminal procedure gloss that you can add to that?
No, not really. I think mm-hmm. that you gave the best broad strokes that I can give.
Okay.
You know, I had just a hard time believing that $67 million worth of assets are justified in being taken. You know, it doesn't seem like when you're doing civil forfeiture, asset forfeiture, it's you're taking, you know, assets that were illegally acquired or useful to, you know, further crimes. And I don't see, I don't know, it's, I need to dig down into these actual claims to know for sure. It just seems incredulous when you read it.
Right. Mike, any thoughts on the Supreme Court declining to meddle with what has happened already in this case?
Well, as we were speaking before a few weeks ago with Mr. Delahanty, mm-hmm. you know, just always is surprising to see the breadth of these civil forfeiture laws here in the U.S. I mean, it's incredible what the federal government can do. Of course, this fight is not over. Kim.com is now going to fight the authorities, I think, both in New Zealand and Hong Kong from releasing the assets to the U.S. government. So this was appears to be just kind of phase one in what's probably going to be a multi-phase defense or attack. So it'll be interesting to watch and see what happens here. But pretty significant setback, I would say, for Kim.com and his legal team.
Right. And for those interested in the asset forfeiture laws and how they develop and morph by being analyzed by courts, this is one less shot of a court, the highest court in our land, to weigh in on those laws and how they should be applied. The Supreme Court hasn't decided to wade into it here. Let us move on or move back in time, if we can, to the, well, we're here in the wake of this mass shooting in Las Vegas. After we talk about the story, I want to ask you guys if you've heard anything related to this story, in connection with the Las Vegas shooting. But a story that we talked about on the show for a very long time involved the mass shooting in San Bernardino County by Syed Farouk here in California, and the search that the FBI wanted to do of his phone, which Apple declined to get involved in and declined to alter iOS so that the FBI could backdoor into devices like this and find out what was going on. What happened eventually is the Justice Department dropped its lawsuit against Apple because it found a third party that would help it bypass the iPhone's security system. Various news organizations, the Associated Press, Vice News, and USA Today filed a FOIA action related to that series of events and wanted to find out a couple of things. Wanted to find out who the FBI had hired and wanted to find out how much it cost. A federal judge has just determined that the plaintiffs there, the news organizations, are not going to be able to find out either thing. On the one hand, they the judge, her name is Tanya Chutkan, if I'm saying her name properly. She found that the third party who enabled access to the phone, if they're identity were publicly known and acknowledged, and I think a lot of people think they know who the third party was, but if it was known and confirmed that that's who the FBI used, she was concerned, and she agreed with the government's arguments on this, that it would put them in jeopardy, that their own security systems, even though this was probably a security firm of some kind, might not be sufficient to fend off the cyber attacks that they might be subject to if it were publicly known and acknowledged that they had played this role. So she decided to protect the identity of that company, and she also declined to confirm that the price was around $1 million, which is what FBI Director James Comey and Senator Dianne Feinstein have both said. But the judge said she's not willing to pin down the exact price and put a, you know, U.S. government stamp of approval on what it was, because releasing the price would, put a value on that kind of technology, and it would help adversaries, know whether or not the FBI would be willing to invest or try and ballpark whether the FBI would be willing to invest that kind of technology to access their encrypted devices. So, interesting turn of events. Emery, were you surprised by this?
Surprised? No. More than a little disappointed. I find the arguments a little specious, I think. There's so much here, right? So, if we look to the way that freedom of information access is supposed to work, it's supposed to strongly favor disclosure, except in circumstances where there's national security risks. I think specifically, I can read from her judgment, but it says that the issue that the two parties disagreed on was element 4 of Executive Order 13.526, which governs the classification of national security information, which requires that the original classification authority determine that the unauthorized disclosure of the information reasonably could be expected to result in damage to the national security, which includes defense against transnational terrorism, and the original classification authority is able to identify or describe the damage. So I think that it's a really weak argument both to say that there's a national security risk here, and that the damage was actually identified or described. So the argument essentially that the FBI made and that was successful was that, as you said, the disclosure of the cost and the name of the company is a national security risk, both because it essentially puts a lot of risk on the third party vendor, that the vendor would be basically outed to the community, and that as a result of that, other hackers would be able to attack that vendor. The vendor would not be able to withstand those cyber attacks, and thus the tool that the FBI relied on would potentially be released to the hackers. And I think that there's some problems with that, basically because if you look at the facts of this case, this was an exploit that was done on an iPhone 5S, I guess, not the SE, but the 5S. So it's an iPhone that's no longer even being manufactured right now. A security hole that doesn't exist anymore for iPhones. iPhones, unlike a lot of Android phones, see updates regularly, and so it's even less likely that the exploit that worked on the 5S would continue to work for new phones. And even if you buy the admittedly weak argument that this third-party firm would be less likely or able to defend themselves from cyber attacks than the FBI, which I don't necessarily see why that is reasonable to believe, considering the FBI had to go to the third party vendor to get their work done. So even if you buy that, I don't buy the argument that disclosing the price that they paid would reveal too much information. I mean, FOIA is necessary and crucially important oversight of government activities. And this type of activity was novel and precedential and worrisome to a lot of people. And I think that, you know, it is I think it's totally in America's best interest for us as citizens to know how much these exploits cost, how it is part of the whole decision process that we can, you know, the discussion around the encryption, quote unquote, debate and the war on terror and the ways that our government is dealing with, you know, technology and encryption. So I find it really disappointing, and I think the arguments are a stretch. And I don't really see how, Justice Chutkan reasoned. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like she went along with the government's arguments in fairly lockstep here. It was an iPhone 5C, not an
5C,
S.
Sorry.
And we have a geeky enough audience that those kinds of things matter to get right.
Absolutely. Thank you for correcting me.
I will hear about it after the fact. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, I have a slightly different take on this case. I mean, sometimes these are difficult decisions. I agree with the Freedom of Information Act analysis that Emery laid out, that, you know, freedom of information, this statute, both the federal statute and a lot of state statutes, including the one in your neck of the woods there in California, you know, they strongly favor disclosure. But there are limits. And this was such a novel issue involving a very tragic incident. And it really gets to the heart of the FBI's investigative techniques and other particulars that I think the judge was rightly justified in saying, look, this, although, you know, there's an interest in the public accessing this information, it's clearly outweighed by the detriments associated with the disclosure. So, you know, I think this is one on which reasonable minds could differ. But I tend to fall in line with the judge's analysis here.
All right. So to pivot slightly off of San Bernardino, but before I do that, Emery, did you have a final thought?
I mean, I guess my problem is that San Bernardino may have been the flashpan case that started this process, this practice, but we know that it's, you know, the act of using third-party vendors, cyber mercenaries, you know, out-of-country hackers, whatever you want to call them, to unlock iPhones and Android phones, you know, trying to get around encryption by exploiting exploits in the hardware. I mean, that is practice right now. And there's just not much oversight of that. And we don't know, as the public doesn't know how much these exploits are costing. I mean, I can put on my my hat that gives the most leeway to this argument and goes so far as to say that, okay, don't give away the identity of the third party vendor that gave this hack out. I can buy that, but I just don't see the reasoning for not revealing the cost, you know, especially in a period of our country where there is a lot of talk about either reining back, you know, spending, or, you know, we're cutting, we don't have the article on the show notes anymore, but, you know, cutting back on Obama phones while we're not knowing that, you know, we're spending $1.5 million per exploit to unnamed, maybe foreign nationals to do unnamed, you know, black clouded work for police departments around the country. Like, it's just, we don't know anything about this. The price, right. Just let us have the price. Then we can move forward and have a more informed discussion about how we want this to work.
Yeah, it's a good point, Emery. And I think that, you know, anybody interested in knowing about how much something like this would cost could find that out pretty easily without needing to know exactly what the government was charged. Although it's good to know what the, you know, as taxpayers, it's always good to know what the government is charged. We will get to those Obama phone and other access to technology issues. We had a guest slotted for this week who had to beg off for family reasons, but we're going to have her back again soon, and we will get to those issues then. What I wanted to sort of see if your information streams had fed you anything different than what I've been seeing is I was sort of expecting to see coverage about what was on the Las Vegas shooter's devices or searching those devices. Granted, it's not even been a week since this horrific act took place. But I'm wondering, you know, if the context in which this presents itself, public national story, 59 people dead, or maybe it's 58 now. They adjusted the numbers instead of 14 in San Bernardino, and so many people injured. That I'm wondering if concerns about accessing this shooter's technology have gone so to the back of people's minds that this is a non-story for that reason. Of course, people want his technology accessed. They want all evidence and answers possible as to why this happened. But also, I have seen sort of a deafening silence around the issue, and I've been searching and looking and haven't come up with it. You know, nothing seems to be reported about this yet. Again, it's quite early. But maybe this is a conscious strategy of law enforcement here too, just to not publicize what they're doing to gather the information that must be on computers and phones and things that were used by this shooter. The only thing that has been reported a lot is his lack of a social media presence, which is making it challenging for law enforcement to put pieces together from those kinds of tidbits. Mike, have you seen anything about this shooter's devices or data on them?
I have not seen a thing. I think it's a really interesting point you raise. Of course, we're still somewhat in the nascent stages of this investigation, and we'll see what happens here. Apparently, there's 100 FBI agents that are devoted to investigating this case. So it would not surprise me at all if we hear more about this particular issue as time wears on here.
Yeah. Any further thoughts on that, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, I would be hugely surprised if we ever see law enforcement ever make a public request to one of the big five or tech companies to actually, you know, their own encryption. I think that, again, San Bernardino established the practice. You know, if we're not hearing about it, it's probably because they're putting out contracts for people to break it, which, again, like, I'm not necessarily against that practice. You know, like, I certainly prefer paying hackers or paying entrepreneurs to go, to exploit exploits in hardware than getting companies to create backdoors to their encryption, you know, and that encourages companies to make better devices. I don't have necessarily a problem with that. Just a little bit more transparency, a little bit of oversight.
Right. Yes. So a final criminal justice related story, again, hearkening back to our episode with Mr. Delahanty, has to do with something we talked a lot about on that show, and that is how global our society has become, and that legal principles related to discovery and jurisdiction and all kinds of things are sort of thrown into chaos because of it. And this story is a good example of that. There are federal prosecutors in a case seeking to have Google sanctioned because they have obtained a duly issued, court-issued search warrant requesting certain Google user data. And what Google has done is it has turned over everything that it has that is within the scope of the warrant that is stored in the U.S. But everything that is stored overseas, Google has said, no, we don't have to comply with that. There's a case in the Second Circuit, and we've talked about this case on the show, which found that Microsoft didn't have to produce data that it had housed on a foreign server. I think that was Ireland. And Google, even though it's in a different jurisdiction than the Second Circuit, says that's the law of the land now, and we don't have to produce things that we store overseas. Of course, Google stores things everywhere, right? And who knows what sort of strategies they employ to decide what gets stored in the U.S. and what gets stored overseas. It seems like sort of a strange distinction to make. What the prosecutors are saying is if it can be accessed from the U.S., it should be produced in response to this warrant. The prosecutors are also saying, hey, Google, you had the chance to oppose the warrant before it was issued, and you didn't. You're just refusing to comply with it now, and that's not the right way to go either. Mike, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, if I read this correctly, I think Google was asking to be found, or their lawyers were saying, look, we want a contempt order so we can immediately appeal it, if I've got that right, which I thought was, you know, pretty interesting. You know, it's not all that often that a lawyer says, find my client in contempt so we can move forward. So they're clearly looking to set precedent here with this case, trying to align itself with the Second Circuit ruling. Interesting maneuver. Obviously a very, very important issue for Google. Otherwise, they wouldn't be saying find us in contempt here. So
I'm really sad that you brought that up, because of course my mind went straight to Monty Python and the scene with Sir Galahad and spank me, no, spank me.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Sorry.
Oh, yes.
Just had to give you all that.
Right.
Spank Google. sorry, didn't derail you too badly. Go on.
No, that's, you know, boy, what can I say in response to that? Nothing further.
All right. What do you think, Emery? I mean, it seems like such a strange and 2017 issue to be arguing that it matters where the data is to respond to a warrant. Do you think that Google's in the right here or no?
I mean, I don't know. I think that it is a difficult argument for the prosecutors to make that if it's accessible in the U.S., that it has to be able to be produced in the U.S. Because as we know, the internet, I mean, that just doesn't seem to make sense, right? Any European company that has data in, you know, it is entirely stored in Europe, but that you can access on the internet in America, it doesn't really seem like that should be able to be produced. But at the same time, It is an interesting case, you know. I mean, data portability and how and where our data can be stored and transferred overseas is a rapidly evolving issue. So it is something to watch for sure.
Yeah, you know, I think you raise an interesting point there, Emery. I can tell you in a civil context, if this was just an ordinary commercial dispute, that well, every case is different, of course, but I would say generally speaking, if the data is accessible to one of the parties to a commercial lawsuit, assuming that it's sufficiently relevant or germane to the suit and it's not incredibly difficult for it to be produced, a court's going to say you have to produce it. You know, there's this concept of proportionality that we now have in the context of civil litigation. So you always are weighing, you know, the proportional benefits associated with the production and how difficult it's going to be. But I mean, if it's simply just a matter of, you know, more or less a few keystrokes or you know, you can get it fairly easily and readily, you know, courts are definitely erring on the side of saying, hey, look, produce it. This could have completely different implications. Maybe it's not as simple as it appears to be, but you know, I can tell you, having dealt with a bunch of discovery disputes involving e-discovery, that it can look kind of simple in one regard, but then when you really drill down and get beneath the surface, you know, there's lots of different issues at play here. So.
And there is some legislation pending. There are a couple of things that this back and forth with Google underscores. Number one is, if law enforcement wants your emails, all they have to do is serve a subpoena on Google or wherever your email is stored, and they'll likely get at least some of it. And maybe there will be some argument that it's stored on foreign servers, and we can talk about whether that it should be produced then. But it's, you know, very accessible to law enforcement if they go through the right steps. There is a piece of legislation that is proposed with bipartisan backing called the International Communications Privacy Act, which continues to honor this where's the data stored distinction, and if enacted would make it harder to, and would lend some clarity to the issue on when you could obtain data that is not stored in the U.S. if you're seeking it in a proceeding that is taking place in the U.S. A court would have to find that the government has taken all reasonable steps to establish the nationality and location of the customer whose communications are sought, and that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the customer is a U.S. person located in the U.S. or a foreign national whose country has a law enforcement cooperation agreement with the U.S. So I guess the logical corollary to that is that if you say maybe like Kim.com are not a U.S. citizen, and this doesn't apply to Kim.com. I'm pretty sure that New Zealand has a law enforcement cooperation agreement with the U.S., but I haven't looked that up recently. That if you were in a country that didn't, and you were not a U.S. citizen, that your data then could be protected from discovery by law enforcement in the United States under this proposed International Communications Privacy Act. So in addition to, there's some momentum around reforming and updating the Electronic Communications Privacy Act as well. Emery, do you think that enacting this proposed law is a good idea?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
You're my privacy guy. Come on.
I know. I don't have a good answer right now. I got distracted. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was probably tuned out. I do that, by the way. I'll just cop to it. I'll just let you answer, and then I'll be like, yeah, that sounded good. Just to catch you up, maybe if the person's not in the U.S., not a U.S. citizen, and is in a country that doesn't have a law enforcement cooperation agreement with the U.S., a U.S. or their email data wouldn't be valid under this new proposed act. Do you think that's a good idea?
Again, I guess I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think that through a little more, you know. I think that, again, Mike has more experience with e-discovery, and I have a hard time finding problems with that, but I can imagine it would make it very difficult for some lawsuits that certainly need to happen for good cause. You know, I'm not in favor of just not allowing evidence to be admitted just because the data is not stored in America solely.
Right.
But, you know, I like the language so far.
Yeah, I see all this as sort of a chess game on the part of both email users on the one hand and email providers on the other, as to, you know, who you pick for your provider and what decisions providers make as far as where they're going to store data. I think all of this is very important because some strategic decisions are going to be made on both fronts around both the finding in this case and then this proposed legislation that may be enacted. So it's definitely, as most things are, we know when it comes to technology and the law, a cat and mouse game. And I'm just trying to see if I can look down the road and see where this is going. Where I think it might be going is more data gets stored overseas in countries that don't have law enforcement cooperation agreements with the U.S. If companies want to be able to say to their customers, we're going to protect your data. Mike, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a reasonable prediction as to where this is headed. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. It's going to be, where's the data? We put these phrases into the show in case you are watching or listening and hoping to apply for MCLE credit in your jurisdiction, if you're a lawyer, or professional credit in your field, if you are not. Some of our listeners and viewers do that. So we've put some resources together for you at wiki.twit.tv. If you are a lawyer, find our This Week in Law page there. If you're a lawyer in the U.S., we have some information for you as to how you might go about applying for credit in your jurisdiction for watching or listening to the show. And we put these phrases in case you need to demonstrate to someone that you actually watched or listened. We are not an approved provider ourselves, but we certainly want to support anyone who wants to apply for credit for watching or listening to the show. So we'll put another passphrase in before the end of this episode of This Week in Law. And next we'll move on to a journalism-related topic involving the Supreme Court. This could be a law and policy topic, too. I put it under journalism because transparency and because what the Supreme Court of the United States does is certainly news in each and every instance of a case that it decides. And for those not terribly familiar with the Supreme Court, it makes its oral arguments available only after the oral argument has taken place, and it only makes them available in audio form. So the parties know when they're in there arguing before the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. The lawyers know and the justices know they're being recorded and that that audio will be released, but there are no cameras in the courtroom and it is not live streamed, either the audio or the video. And the court has recently decided that that is the way things are going to stay, even though there is a contingent of Congress people who have been seeking more access to the court, really would like the court to live stream its audio, its not just the audio, but the video of the arguments. The court has said that it thinks that will change the dynamic of things in the courtroom. It thinks it will negatively impact the way the justices and counsel before them or parties before them interact with each other. I think it's kind of a, if it's not broke, don't fix it scenario. The court likes the way things work now. The court has worked things this way for a very, very long time and doesn't want to change the dynamic to have a live national or international audience while arguments are taking place. So the court has said thank you for your request. We've considered it. We are not going to live stream our arguments now or anytime soon. Emery, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, maybe predictably, I'm in favor of just live stream the things. Your argument that, you know, it's going to fundamentally change the way or the format or the results of arguments that are made, I think is specious. Creating a culture of deference to the court is important. You know, it's why judges wear fancy robes and, you know, they're seated higher up and our courtrooms look like churches. It's all, you know, part of that mind games to make us as a culture give deference to the court. I think that's totally reasonable and a good enough reason. Just make that argument. Make the argument that we want to keep this antiquated system because it helps create deference to the court and it helps, you know, separate that, create that air of mystique. I think that is a more believable argument that can then be defeated on those grounds than the idea that just having cameras up and streaming them passively to the internet or to the world would fundamentally change the way things are working. But that's just me.
Yeah, and different courts do things differently. I know the Ninth Circuit live streams some of its arguments that it finds particularly important that it knows that there's going to be a lot of interest in. Now, being able to access those streams is something else entirely if they are controversial and really popular and people really want to tune in and listen. It frequently overwhelms the system that the courts put in place, so you're left not being able to listen or watch anyway. So I just don't know if, you know, given what other courts are doing, the Supreme Court is ready for this kind of prime time. It would certainly be not just bad for the give and take in the argument as the court fears, but I think it would be bad for the image of the court if it were giving public access and the whole system was broken and inaccessible, which I fear would be the case. But
yeah, I guess how many times does C-SPAN have problems? You know, yeah. I mean, would it really be that difficult to just? I don't know. I feel like the educational use, the transparency use, like this is a potentially, you know, it's already been hard enough to go through Pacer, but to just be able to let anyone that wants to know the law, that wants to, you know, that may be interested in practicing the law later for, you know, students, high school students, young people, this could be such a resource. And it's just so incredible that it's not available already.
Right. And the other thing that always comes up in these kinds of discussions is, well, the oral arguments are open to the public. If you really wanted to attend and you were, you know, even more eager to gain access to a Supreme Court oral argument than you were to gain access to that, you know, iPhone that you waited in line 4 years ago, then maybe you might gain access. But it's not easy to get in.
Yeah, you could wake up at 6 a.m. and be at the front door at 7 a.m. and be one of the whatever 50, 100 people that maybe fit in the courtroom within the first 10 minutes of them opening the doors if you live in Washington, D.C. But if I live in California, most people don't live in Washington, D.C., in fact. So
really?
I'm not a statistics person, but I'm just pulling that one. It might be incorrect. Feel free to correct me, listeners.
Nope. I'm fairly confident that most people don't live in Washington, D.C. What about you, Mike? Do you think that the Supreme Court made the right choice here?
No, I do not. I'm a huge proponent of having court proceedings televised. I think it would be incredibly educational, beneficial to the public. I just don't buy any of these arguments. You know, Justice Scalia was always a huge opponent of having video feeds in the courtroom. And his take was, look, this will miseducate people. It won't educate them. And I think his point was something along the lines of, you know, we deal primarily with a lot of boring statutory issues with ERISA and patent law and some of these other federal statutes that – And the oral argument is only just a small snippet of what the court does. You know, a lot of the court's work, the vast majority of it, takes place in private anyway, in conferences and drafts of opinions. And so to just have a portion of the court's work televised would miseducate Americans. I don't know if I buy that at all. As a matter of fact, I don't buy it. I think it would be great for anybody that wants to be able to access hearings to see them. The Ninth Circuit, as you pointed out, Denise, has you can access theirs on YouTube. Actual videos of oral arguments, which I've done several times. And as you pointed out, they also have been live streaming some very important cases. The Trump travel ban appeal, when that was appealed up to the Ninth Circuit, that was there was a live, at least an audio feed. I remember listening to it. I don't think there was a video feed, but stuff like that, that's incredibly important. And I think for, probably the vast majority of folks in the country wouldn't be interested in it, but for those of us on this show and that are listening, it's something that would be incredibly helpful and beneficial for us to be able to access. So, yeah, this will happen eventually. It's probably going to take another generation or so before we get to Supreme Court access and we get a little bit different philosophical bent there, but it will happen. Maybe not.
I do like,
maybe not in my lifetime as a lawyer, but it will happen.
Well, by then, will we even have Supreme Court justices? Won't all justice be dispensed by artificial intelligence
by
at that point in time?
That's right.
I do like the idea of like networked classrooms or law school classes, or a Discord chat, Twitch chat maybe. There's lots of people, all 10,000, 50,000 people watching the live stream of the argument at once, and posting memes and the like. It's I think that
we're headed that way.
I'm just
way,
a real big nerd. I like it.
I want to hear the back channel to all the Supreme Court argument involves. I think that would be really interesting. And you know what? We get it. Well, we don't get it live, but we do get some flavor of this, even if there's not something like our wonderful IRC chat that goes along with all our Twitch shows. But we do get something like this on Twitter. Twitter's been getting such a bad rap lately. But when it comes to people giving live accounts, say they did. You're a journalist or you're just a really interested person with a Twitter account and you've gotten into an important argument. And you're live tweeting and you have amazing insights on what's going on in the courtroom. That's very, very valuable. Hmm. And it happens all the time. I know, well, for example, in the monkey selfie case, yay, we get to talk about it, even though it's not in the news this week. People were hanging on every word that happened in the courtrooms during that case, and tweeting and deconstructing. And granted, it's maybe not life shattering for every citizen of the planet, but enough people were interested enough in it that it got an incredible amount of real time coverage, even if things were not being live streamed. Of course, then you get into the question of, to what extent can you have a device in the courtroom and be doing that? And I know that there are many courtrooms that limit your ability to do that. So it's a back and forth. Also a back and forth is the whole discovery process in a case, which we've alluded to already during the show. Let's talk about it in more detail in the context of the dispute between Google/Waymo and Uber. And this is under the topic of trademarks and trade secrets. So the case drags on. It has a trial date now. This is the huge lawsuit by Waymo, purchased by Google, against Uber involving trade secrets that Uber allegedly took from having hired an engineer, a former Waymo engineer named Anthony Lewandowski, who wants to form his own religion. And we've talked about that on the show before. Google that if you don't know what I'm talking about. It's pretty good. But totally off topic for what we're discussing here today, which has to do with the fact we have a trial date, which is December 4th. The jury's going to be picked on November 29th. You were not with us last week, Mike, when we noticed and discussed the fact that one of the trade secrets, it came out in discovery, something that came out in documents that were filed with the court, merely one of the trade secrets involved in the case was valued at $2.6 billion. And yeah, I'm wondering, Mike, if you have you ever seen a trade secret case that involved evaluation of one trade secret that was so high?
Nothing comes to mind. That's a rather staggering amount, to be sure.
Right. But then what's happened recently is both parties have gotten a serious bench slapping from Judge Alsup, their judge in the case, U.S. District Judge William Alsup, not happy with the way the parties have handled various discovery issues, not happy with the fact that Uber's lawyers asked for a different and or later trial date than December 4th, particularly because of the way that they had not produced documents related to Anthony Lewandowski's email accounts. Basically, you've just got a really angry judge saying, nope, you guys have, you know, made this mess, and whatever the mess is, we're going to have a trial and we're going to have it on December 4th. And if you wanted it some other way, you should have conducted yourselves differently beforehand. Mike, did you take a look at all this?
Yeah, I did. I did read a bit about it. You know, Judge Alsup, he's not a judge that you want to infuriate, because he will let you have it. And it sounds like he did just that in this case. Kind of a pox on both houses, it sounds like. You know, and you know, set the trial date, you know, right around Thanksgiving, picking the jury at that point. One of the lawyers, and I can't remember for what side, was double booked and was set to pick a jury or start a trial right around that same time. And the judge essentially said, I'm sorry, we'll miss you, that you won't be here, but you know, we're going to carry on without you. So, you know, not very sympathetic. You know, oftentimes courts will do something like this, set a trial at very inconvenient times for counsel and the parties as a way to encourage the parties to maybe get together and settle the case. And so that might be going on in the background here, that the judge is using his power of scheduling a case to encourage cooler heads to prevail and see if they can't just resolve their differences here. But I'm not sure. This case may be so far gone that they just got to try the case because both sides are so entrenched.
Right. I think you're onto something there. Joe Mullen wrote this up for Ars Technica and has some quotes from the judge from this hearing, where the judge was giving some opinions as to what he thinks is going on in the lawyers and the parties' heads here involving Waymo. Judge Alsup says, I think when Waymo got into this case, it thought it was going to get into the files and find an exact duplicate of the Waymo files. As it turns out, the product is dissimilar in a lot of ways. It may even be a vast improvement over what was going on at Waymo. So they've come up short there. So I see what you're saying, Mike, that this is the judge sort of speculating what's going on. And definitely, I think, trying to say, hey, you know, Google / Waymo, you probably haven't found everything you hoped you would. And maybe it's time to start thinking of settling this potentially $2.6 billion plus case. You agree?
I totally agree. You know, when the judge is forecasting, you know, his or her take on the evidence, you know, depending on what side your client is on, you may be thrilled or you may be dejected when the court does that. It can be a bit unsettling, and I think it is all part of the process of the court trying to say, hey, look, parties, you know, there's some potential risks here on both sides, to be sure. And maybe you need to be thinking about resolving the case.
Yep, absolutely. Emery, any thoughts about this?
I just want to read a couple more quotes to really, I mean, it's great listening to judges give smackdowns. It really is when it's when you're not in front of them. But to your point, Denise, one of the lines I liked is, when this case started, Waymo had a strong case against Lewandowski, but it didn't sue Lewandowski. It sued Uber, which I think is, sort of the crux of the whole thing. And then also just to give the exact quote that Mike was describing earlier, one of the attorneys asked, for a delay because they had they're going to pick a jury for a different trial on November 27th, the Monday after Thanksgiving. The response was, well, you only need three of the lawyers over there to try this case. We are going to miss you greatly. I was looking forward to seeing you perform in this case, but next time, maybe you ought to produce the documents.
Scorch
chills. Like, ouch.
Yeah, that was Uber's lawyer, and Judge Alsup was not happy with Uber with the way that it treated Lewandowski's emails. Uber also said just this weekend, Joe Mullen writes, that it found that Lewandowski's emails from his startup auto trucking hadn't been properly migrated to Uber and weren't produced. So the judge says, that seemed remarkable to me after 25 years of doing what you lawyers have been doing and 18 years on the bench. The most important witness in this case, somehow his own files got overlooked. That's very suspicious. So Judge Alsup wasn't happy with Uber about all that. And
Kylo in the I might be pronouncing it Kylo in the chat just chimed in that says that this judge probably wouldn't mind being streamed, and I think you're right.
That's probably right. Yes. No objections there. All right, where were we going to go on to? We were going to go on to looking at the six strikes policy. The current status of it, which takes us down the road from me here over in Hollywood. So there's something fairly fascinating going on with the six strikes policy, which I guess appropriately enough, as we're entering into the month of October, is supposed to be dead, but seems to be undead. It died a death early this year when it basically was phased out. It was not going to be enforced anymore. But the funny thing about it is people continue to get warnings, these six strike policy kind of warnings. This is something that Torrent Freak, unsurprisingly, is keeping up with, monitoring chats and message boards and things among people who have received such notices. And it seems that even though the six-strike policy doesn't exist anymore, the notices keep going out. Many people are reporting getting the basic notices, the first-time offender notices. But Torrent Freak reports that there seems to be a bit of a trend of internet connections being suspended or otherwise interrupted, apparently as a result of an infringement notice being received. And that would be some of the more, higher level repeat offender kind of notices. And the reason I find this all pretty interesting is because there's a case pending on appeal right now before the Fourth Circuit that involves BMG Rights Management got a judgment in their trial court against Cox Communications as the ISP for not aggressively enough, according to BMG, going after repeat infringers, customers on their network and ignoring requests to terminate those subscribers. BMG in that trial recovered $25 million against Cox and also $8 million in attorney's fees. So this thing is up on appeal. And, an appellate court's going to weigh in and see if they think, the result was right, the amounts are proper, et cetera, et cetera. So that's going to be heard next month. And I think in the meantime, you've got some pretty skittish ISPs out there who don't want to be the next Cox. So perhaps, I'm just speculating here, that's why these notices continue to emanate from the, as an offshoot of the now dead slash undead Six Strikes program. So maybe we'll know more when there's argument and ultimately a determination on this BMG Cox case. But in the meantime, I think we've got some fairly snake bit ISPs out there who don't want to be the next Cox. Do you agree, Emery?
Yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, I think that that's absolutely it. You know, the ending of the Six Strikes program, on the one hand, meant that these shouldn't go out. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that the activity isn't copyright infringement. And we also know that, you know, as the Six Strikes program was up, there was a whole sort of cottage industry of businesses that were monitoring torrents and were assisting, you know, rights holders and actually providing that process to give to or give notice to ISPs that they should be sending out these warnings. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's a combination of skittishness over BMG v. Cox, or just some of these companies are and maybe a combination of that with some of these companies that have already had the infrastructure and the systems and processes in place to be monitoring these torrents or this infringing activity, just sort of keeping on peddling. You know, for consumers on the one hand, getting rid of the Six Strikes program doesn't really sound encouraging, in that as flawed as the program may have been, either in its, you know, efficacy at getting people to stop pirating, or on, you know, the way it was wielded, maybe brutishly, I think that getting rid of it really just gets rid of any kind of what little predictability there was. So now we have consumers that are getting these notices, and the consumers may or may not know that the Six Strikes program doesn't exist anymore. You know, they may, these notices, by the way, may or may not be from the actual ISPs. It may be from these other companies that are monitoring this stuff. They may be, you know, contracted with the RIAA or something. So it's something to pay attention to. That's basically my take on it.
Right. There are a couple of just interesting ramifications from this. Torrent Freak points out that it may matter. You know, people are trying to get around getting these notices and quote unquote getting caught on these various message boards that Torrent Freak is monitoring. People are suggesting paid VPNs and chastising one another if they're not using those. So I think, you know, the VPNs have to pay attention to this too. And if you're a VPN that is marketing yourself to this crowd of users, you have to do so at your own risk. Obviously, there are many good uses for a VPN that don't involve infringing copyright at all. But, you know, from a business model and management standpoint, if I'm a VPN, I'm being very careful not to get into the sites here. The other thing I think is really interesting is the question of whether, you know, are you downloading new stuff or old stuff? And what Torrent Freak writes is, while there is plenty of evidence to suggest that old content is also monitored, there's little doubt that the fresher the content, the more likely it is to be monitored by copyright holders. If people are downloading a brand new movie, they should expect it to be monitored somewhere by someone. So,
yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Little nuggets, you know, there. Yeah.
It would be really dumb not to be, if you were a rights holder, not to be monitoring torrents. You know, I mean, it's. And when you seed the torrent, you can see everyone else that's downloading and seeding it. You can see their IP address. So it would be trivial to do that. And, you know, if, not at all surprised.
Yeah. And again, every time we discuss the fact that torrenting is still a thing and that notices are still going out and lawsuits involving torrenting are still wending their way through the courts, I'm just really surprised that this is still, you know, a significant way that people are consuming their entertainment rather than, you know, borrowing the HBO password of a good friend or something. You know, I mean, it seems like there are a lot of avenues for legally getting to what you want to watch nowadays. And that's a good thing. It's a huge change from when I first started practicing law in this area.
I mean, but, I think the six
but
strikes,
it's not squelching it entirely.
Yeah. I mean, the six strikes process, I think, was maybe the least effective of the multi-pronged approach that, you know, RIAA, MPAA, and the other major rights holders, you know, strategically chose, or I guess chose for their strategy to you know, limit and re-educate online pirates. And it is remarkable how much the landscape has changed just in the past 5 years. How, you know, I think it's just because companies like Netflix and Hulu have just made it easier than downloading things illegally. But at the end of the day, you're always going to have people that don't have the money, you know, younger people or people overseas or people in impoverished people that are just not going to have the money to be buying that DVD, and they're going to download it illegally. I just don't think that's ever something that is going to be able to be completely deleted.
Yep.
Or erased.
Good point. Mike, thoughts?
No, I agree with everything that you guys were just saying. You know, the BMG case is obviously very important to every single ISP in the land. You know, the court's going to squarely address, or at least we assume the court's going to squarely address what it constitutes to be a repeat infringer and what an ISP's obligations are with respect to when somebody is a repeat infringer. Obviously, very important issue, and it's something we'll definitely be taking a look at here closely.
Yeah, we would definitely will, especially when it's argued. It was a while ago that the trial court decision came out, and I'm not pulling up in my own memory databases exactly what the theory was against Cox, but I'm guessing it was that they were found to be infringing themselves in a contributory way.
They had argued that they could avail themselves of the DMCA safe harbors, saying that look, we didn't have specific knowledge related to acts of infringement and so on and so forth. And of course, Judge O'Grady in the case found, I think it's summary judgment, that they weren't entitled to the safe harbor because they were on notice of many repeat instances of infringement. And ultimately, they lost their safe harbor provision. The case was tried, I think, to a jury, as I recall, and the jury came back with the $25 million verdict. So it was a pretty flagrant case of the ISP just kind of turning a blind eye to what was going on its network. And I think that was something that certainly caught the judge's ire, and ultimately the jury wasn't happy with it either. So you're right. It really was a contributory infringement verdict. Where they were tagged with that judgment as a result of what their users were doing on the network.
Right.
The minor point on that is that also I think it's important that the infringing activity and whether the infringers were repeat infringers is a point of order, you know, whether or not it's just that, again, rights holders have notified Cox or an ISP that this user is likely infringing. Does that count as them automatically being guilty of being an infringer, or do they have to be deemed to be an infringer in court before that repeat infringing status, you know, holds? So other than that, yeah, exactly as Mike described.
Right. And that was sort of the knock on the whole copyright alert system, six strikes program. From the inception, is that people were going to be receiving notices and perhaps ultimately losing their service without an actual adjudication that they'd done anything wrong. Because Hollywood, because that's what they wanted. And this was the thing that the accord that they reached with ISPs and then decided not to pursue earlier this year. So it'll
Mickey
be interesting.
Mouse is really good at getting those laws.
Yeah. All right, let's stick with the copyright rubric, but move ourselves out of the entertainment arena a bit. All right. I have to thank listener Christopher, who emailed us about the Google Clips camera that was announced this week. It has been getting a lot of attention on the privacy front. It's a little square camera that is driven by AI under the hood and is sort of always on in the room. It's not designed to be a wearable. Here, let's play some of the Google announcement on it, and we can talk about it a bit afterwards.
With parents and pet owners in mind. So you'll capture more of those spontaneous smiles, first steps, and first tricks. Now, Clips has all the things you would expect from a great camera. A high-performance lens, a powerful image sensor. It has a shutter button. But that's not what this camera is all about. We reimagined this camera from the inside out, starting with the software and applying machine learning to build a camera that takes photos for you, so you can enjoy the moment and instantly get shots you couldn't get before.
They had it on the flower sack there. I'm not sure if you noticed.
It starts with the AI engine at the core of the camera. Let's talk about what that engine does. When you're behind a camera, you look for people you care about. You look for smiles. You look for that moment your dog starts chasing her tail. Clips does all of that for you. Turn it on, and it captures the moment so you can be in the moment. And because the software is at the core of the camera, it's going to get smarter over time. We also reimagine what camera hardware should do for you. Clips is tiny. It weighs almost nothing. So you can easily toss it into your pocket. And it's a hands-free camera, so you can get these amazing new perspectives on your experience. And
okay, Victor, I think we get the idea. Thank you very much. It's a camera that once you've turned it on, stays on and captures what's going on in the room. Google has come out and said, no, it's not a wearable. This is something that you want to be more in the background, more, as he said, you want it to capture the moment so you can be in the moment. So it's not, unlike Google Glass, I think if people remember it won't be very apparent that there's a camera present. So I thought of two things immediately when I saw this announcement and started reading about it. I thought of The Circle, if you've read that book or seen the movie. And I thought of a little camera that I already own called Poto, which is a little bit like this Google Clips camera, except it doesn't involve artificial intelligence. It is something that is designed to be in the room with you, maybe stuck on a wall, and it takes video and stills and is just kind of a selfie capturer device. It, like the Google Clips camera, has opted not to include audio with the videos that it takes, which is something that I think these companies are doing.
Purely for the creep factor.
Yes, to address the creep factor, the privacy factor. So people who have, suggested, gee, you better tell your guests that you have an Echo device in your house and that to some extent it is recording audio so that it can respond to you and do its job. Imagine what you might have to tell them if you have one of these clip cameras in your house. But what Christopher was rightly concerned about, as well as sort of the creepiness privacy aspect of having one of these or many of these around in the environment, is something that comes up when we do our animal selfie of the week each week. It's the AI here that is taking the photos and learning over time, as we heard from the Google announcement, and deciding, what moment of activity near it is interesting enough and different enough to start recording and start capturing that video for you. So there's a copyright question too. There's no videographer here except for the AI inside this camera. So Amory, what are your thoughts?
I mean, on the animal selfie, I think after talking about Naruto as much as we have, I'm pretty much on the camp that I agree with the Copyright Office rules that the author is the individual that, or the human that puts the situation that creates the situation whereby the image or the thing can be captured. So in my mind, it's not as much of a copyright question. I mean, I think that that issue is still reasonable minds can differ. And eventually we're going to have a robot Naruto case that will establish that. But for me, that's not as much of a concern. This camera is, again, the latest step in Google's machine learning and AI driven push for everything, which I'm not entirely on board with. But, you know, from the privacy concerns, there's lots of creep factor with the clips. And Google has said that, there's no creep factor because all this data is encrypted and stored locally. It's not like it's on the cloud and it's just recording. But I don't know. I need some people that are smarter than I to dig into this, because there's no way that the machine learning and AI stuff is being done on the device. So how does Google handle that? And I mean, what is Google getting out of this? I don't know. I don't want to put my cynic hat on it, but I am a little nervous about getting a camera that trains to recognize my face and my wife's face and my cat and know when is the most important point of my life to take a picture, and just trust that data is totally useless to Google. I don't know.
Yeah, it does really an interesting thing to wrap your head around when you consider, the Face ID technology that Google already has with Google Photos. And
the other thing,
database that Google already has with Google Photos. Go on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the value seems huge to Google. And but regardless, the other thing Google announced was that in their latest Pixel phone, they have a feature that, so it's old news that you can say, hey, you're easy, and hey, and it's LA Google. And I'm sorry to all of our listeners that just had their devices alert. But you have phones that are now, listening for key phrases. And when that first came out, everyone was saying, whoa, a phone that's listening to my every word and just going to know when I say, hey, Google, there's some privacy concerns there. But then they were saying, oh, no, don't worry about it. You'll love it. It'll be a useful feature. And it is a very useful feature for a lot of people. But Google has pushed that one step further with their latest Pixel phone, which is not only listening to everything it hears for the Google phrase, the wake up phrase, but it has a feature where it's actually listening for any music whatsoever. And it will automatically listen to music and display the name of any music playing on your lock screen. That was sort of an interesting, maybe surprising jump for me, at least personally, because I don't use those kind of wake up phrases. And it is interesting that we've gone from a device that is purely listening to just for that very specific phrase to a device that's just listening all the time. And by the way, isn't that great? It can show you what you're listening to on your phone. So it's a brave new world. We are entering the world where we're going to have Echo cameras and, everything in our house is connected and webcamming and streaming us. So it's weird.
Yeah. And at least one of the pieces that we have in our rundown for the show today. And if you'd like to read all of those pieces, you can find them at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 402 this week. At least one of the pieces talked about how Google putting it out there in this way and sort of skewing it toward families and parents and things is a way of just sort of increasing their beta test environment for the device and getting a lot of data and information about how people use this, what they use it for, how well it works for them, and really moving its AI universe forward with this device just as one of its tools, which I thought was an interesting observation. And I also thought it was interesting that over at Engadget, let's see, who was the author here? Jessica Condit points out that this is something that people, you know, as creepy as it sounds, as weird as it sounds, it is something that Google has struck a nerve with, that there's something about the cameras that we use now that is suboptimal, that they create a barrier, she writes, between ourselves and the actual experience, fundamentally changing the way we remember that moment, kind of like cameras in the courtroom for the Supreme Court, right? It changes the fundamental experience. Clips removes, she posits, the need to manually take photo or video, allowing people to exist in the moment, secure in the knowledge they'll be able to upload the best bits to Instagram later. But maybe, like the Supreme Court justices and the counsel and parties that argue before them, maybe the presence of a camera would change the environment a bit. Not for the kids, because they wouldn't even know it was there. Not for anybody that you haven't told was there. So that's where the creepiness factor comes back in. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if Google gets the same kind of backlash with this device as it got with Google Glass, or if people like it and they become ubiquitous. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, this raises a lot of interesting issues. I, of course, look at it from the copyright standpoint, which I think the development of AI as it continues to mature just in general, you know, it does raise a very interesting copyright issue because, you know, who does own the copyright? As Amory had pointed out, I think you could make an argument that, well, look, it's the owner of the device who set the device in motion that should own the copyright. But and maybe that's the right decision here with Google Clips. But as AI continues to get more and more sophisticated, I think we're going to have to deal with the issue of, look, these AIs are just creating their own independent content, independent of whoever set the device in motion. And so that's going to have to be dealt with probably legislatively at some point. Here, I think you could make a pretty decent argument that, look, the person that put Google Clips, the device into play or in motion here, didn't really do anything other than set the device up. It's the AI that's now taking control and deciding when pictures are going to be taken, at what precise moment, based on lighting, based on the facial expressions, and so on and so forth. Those are the judgments that a photographer makes. And that's why a photographer owns copyright in the photograph that he or she creates. So I do think this is a pretty intriguing copyright issue that we're going to be continuing to face as we see AI make advances. So it's going to be fun to watch.
Right. It is. And there's one other thing go ahead.
Sorry. Do you think it's that different from setting up a camera for just like using a time lapse? I mean, if I just have like a webcam, if I set up a time lapse to take a photograph every 5 minutes or something of a field, I mean, clearly that doesn't have the same exact issues as the AI, but I mean, it seems very analogous.
No, I think that's right. I think it's similar. I don't know that much about Google Clips other than just what I've read, but it sounds like it will take pictures at a certain time. I mean, it's always on, but it will decide ultimately when pictures are going to be taken under what circumstances. And there sounds like there's a lot of different factors that this AI is going to consider when it's snapping photos. So, but I think you're right. There's maybe a close analogy here to, you know, just setting a camera up on a tripod and doing a time lapse sort of scenario.
Right. I could definitely see Google taking some flack if someone had one of these things in their home and were using it, or, you know, in their mind, it was like a security camera and there was a break-in and they expected the culprit to be captured on film. And for some reason, the AI decided it wasn't interesting enough to record. So no evidence.
Right.
The other thing that bears mentioning, I brought up the fact that neither Poto, which I actually own, or this camera, or I assume others that sort of capture video of you without, well, of course, every camera, your phone camera captures video without telling someone that they're being recorded. But I guess in those instances, you've got enough visual cues that if you're holding a phone up at someone, they're going to know you're either taking a picture, or if you're holding it there for a long time, that they're being recorded, and that video cameras on phones and various other kinds of video cameras have microphones. But I assume that one of the reasons that the clip camera and the photo camera take video without any audio is because we have several two-party consent states in the United States that require the consent of both parties before you can record a conversation. So I assume that part of the reason for this decision is not wanting to get users in trouble in the at least 12 states that we have in the United States that have two-party consent laws, that, oopsie, I accidentally recorded you without having your consent, and I don't have this strong visual cue that I'm holding a camera up to you that is recording you. Instead, the camera is attached, as in the Google launch video there, to a bag of flour in the kitchen, and nobody would think to look there for a recording device.
It does feel like they took some lessons from Google Glass. It feels like that there were some very conscious decisions made there.
Right. So thank you, Christopher, for emailing that in. Interesting issues around the Google Clips camera. And then we have another sort of who has the copyright to what kind of question that I just popped up this morning. It's a music video by a band called The Academic. And in our rundown, I've written The Academic song Bear Claws feat Facebook Delay, because Facebook Delay is an active participant in this music video. And so what the band has done is they have recognized that when you're live streaming using Facebook Live, there is a delay that happens. And it's, you know, rather than see it as an annoyance, the band has noticed this and has incorporated it into its music video and has actually created this wonderful piece that wouldn't have been possible without the Facebook Live delay. So I would posit that Facebook Live is actually performing as one of the band members on this video. Let's watch and listen.
Latency.
To some of it.
Latency is the performer.
Yep. I'd love to know how they stepped it back, too. So what they're doing is they're recording little bits of the song, and they're building on it. And if you're watching the video, you can see that in the background, they started with the singer, then they have the guy with the maraca or whatever that is, the shaky thing. And now they have a guy on keyboards. And you can see each of the former bits going back in infinite reflecting mirror fashion behind them. And the fact that Facebook Live has this built-in delay is, you know, they know exactly how long that delay is. And they're timing each new segment so that they're actually playing along to the delay.
It's definitely something you want to watch. It's a very cool video.
Yeah, so watch the whole thing. The song just builds and gets better and better. But of course, me being me, I figured Facebook would be hitting The Academic up for royalties one of these days. What do you think, Mike?
Well, first off, I watched the video. I thought it was absolutely brilliant what they did. Very, very creative, very clever. But I don't think that there's a viable copyright claim here. The claim would be that they're all joint authors.
And in order to be a joint author under the Copyright Act, you need to have created independently copyrightable content and then have the intent with your co-authors to merge that into a unitary whole. And so even though there was this means or mechanism by which they created this, i.e. the delay with the Facebook Live reproduction or stream, I don't think that that's going to rise to the level of an independent copyrightable interest. So
yes,
I'd say academics, they're going to be the sole owner of this wonderful creation that they made.
Yes, I actually agree with you. I just thought that it would make a good law school exam question, and it was something fun to think about. And what a great video. Emery, anything to add?
Where were all these great law school exam questions when I was in law school?
Clearly, we all need to be teaching, right? I mean, that's
absolutely clearly
in our next lives. All right, let's do one other story before we go ahead and get to our concluding material and wrap the show. And that story has to do with the social web. It's still actually a copyright story, and it was written up at the wonderful blog that your firm does, Mike, called the TMCA, that you post to frequently and well. But this one wasn't one of your posts. It was by Farah Sundergy. Am I saying that right? Sundergy.
Farah Sundergy in our New York office.
Very cool. Yeah. Wrote about the fact, this seems to be a first, maybe, perhaps, that someone has been sued over retweeting something that was contended to be a copyrighted work that was not authorized to be put on Twitter in the first place. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, sure. So this involves a lawsuit filed by a fella by the name of Keith Bell. He is a sports psychologist, and he's written a number of books, apparently. And the Northeastern State basketball team, on their Twitter account, they had tweeted out a page, I believe, from Mr. Bell's book related to commitment or something along those lines.
Yeah, the headline says...
Oh, yeah, what is it? I can't read
it. The headline says, winning isn't normal. That's the heading at the top of the page. And it goes on to talk about how winning is highly unusual and that the importance of wanting it and deciding to act on wanting it. So I couldn't tell. I'd love to know the context if NSU baseball was tweeting this because they were losing or they wanted to burn their opposing team that was losing or if they were tweeting it just motivationally. I don't know, you know, what their motivation was for taking a photo of Keith Bell's book and then posting it to the Twitter account, but the author, Mr. Bell, was not happy about that act to begin with and was not happy about all the retweets.
So he sued, and I'm not sure if he sued NSU basketball or baseball or the university, but he definitely sued the retweeter, a fellow by the name of Jeff Narr, if I remember correctly. And so it does raise a rather interesting issue. Can you be a copyright defendant rightfully for just retweeting something that you've come across on Twitter? So it's the first time, at least that I'm aware of, that somebody was sued for simply retweeting. So it does raise an interesting copyright issue there. I guess the argument would be, look, from the copyright owner's perspective, I own copyright in this particular a work of authorship, i.e. the page winning isn't normal. By you retweeting it, you've republished that to your followers and other folks, thereby violating Section 106, Subsection 3, which gives the copyright owner the exclusive right to publish copies of the work. So interesting development for sure.
Right. And it sort of reminds me of the torrenting issues we were discussing a moment ago, because this post was apparently retweeted at least 206 times. So is he going to go after
200 times? I mean, this is like on Twitter. It's like, okay, you're going to start a lawsuit over 200 retweets. Like that's it's a pretty bad ratio to like go through the lawsuit for. I mean,
right. But who, how are you going to go after 206 defendants too? I mean, that seems like quite an all-in commitment. That's not what Dr. Bell did this time. But like the MPAA, they don't have to sue every potential infringer under copyright law. They're not harmed by not suing every potential infringer. They can pick their infringers and go after them. So, keep us posted, Mike, as to what happens with this. It'll be interesting to see if it goes anywhere or gets tossed out, because how can a retweet be an infringement? I don't know. You'd have to know that the first instance wasn't authorized, I would think, in order for liability to attach.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Denise, because typically mm-hmm. you know, copyright infringement, you don't need a volitional act. You don't need to right. know. Mm-hmm. You can be an innocent infringer. Mm-hmm. And so, again, looking at it from the copyright owner's perspective, they'll say, hey, look, maybe you didn't intentionally infringe, but, it's a strict liability tort mm-hmm. under federal law. If you've infringed, you've infringed whether you intended to or not. So,
right.
But you're right. It seems fundamentally unfair that you could be held liable for copyright infringement by simply retweeting.
So what I'm discerning here is some tension between what you would see if you took the time to bother to read Twitter's terms of service and what copyright law instructs you. Because as you just pointed out, you might not need intention to infringe, but what you're told if you look at Twitter's terms of service is that every user is granting a license to every other user to share the content around. Right. I would have to think that when you marry those together, it's the original person who posts and infringed without clearing rights. Without going Zephyr. To the doctor and yeah.
Zephyr in the chat also brought up a great point, which is with the changes to Twitter's UI, it looks like likes now can be considered retweets if we're considering it from like a copyright infringement perspective, because uh-huh. simply liking something can now make that visible, can publish that to other users on whoever is following your timeline, So,
right.
But
right.
again, like, I mean, I think Mike's right that, there's definitely an argument that you would be maybe an innocent infringer if the license argument from Twitter's terms of service didn't apply. And that, yeah, you can certainly infringe on copyright by tweeting out infringing material. But at the same time, it feels like there's such a strong, clear, fair use argument here that, I mean, at least in this particular case, it seems like a really poor decision to move forward with a lawsuit against a single retweeter.
I totally agree, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Denise. There is a rather significant tension between the application of the statute and the terms of service. Of course, what the copyright owner is going to say is, look, I don't care about what the terms of service say. I can't be bound by those terms of service, or you can't insulate yourself from a federal copyright claim saying mm-hmm. that you were authorized to do what you were doing under the terms of service when I never authorized the initial reproduction to begin with.
Right.
It's going to be interesting. I hope we get a decision out of this, or we get some clarity, because I think it's a really interesting novel issue.
Yeah, I do too. And I think you raise a really good point, Amory, in that people aren't going to know, what does a like mean? And I don't think they really know on any platform what a like means. Does it mean that the thing that you've liked is going to be visible to other people who follow you? Does it mean it's going to be on a list somewhere of all the things that you've liked? I don't think that there's a whole lot of disclosure about that, and certainly no disclosure of the fact that it could lead to liability down the road. Certainly you would think that people at least would give a thought to it could lead to embarrassment if you're liking the wrong thing, like the Ted Cruz affiliated person who liked something untoward
affiliated.
From the senator's Twitter account. So hopefully you're thinking at least about the embarrassment that, you know, that like was public. And at least you're hopefully thinking about that. But are you thinking about liability too? Probably not in your wildest dreams. So RT at your own risk will be our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And with that, we will move on to our animal selfie of the week. Our animal selfie of the week is a tweet. It's not an actual photograph this time around. And it's a tweet that was brought to my attention via Scott Robinson. Thank you, Scott. It is a tweet from Andrew Main, who I've told has been a guest on the Twit Network before. And the tweet itself merely shares the fact from Andrew, had a dream last night. A pack of tigers tranquilized me and took selfies with my unconscious body. And of course, I then went hunting around on the interwebs to try and find examples of tiger selfies that we could put along with Andrew's tweet. And what I learned was fairly interesting, that tiger selfies are a thing, and they're such a thing that they've actually been outlawed in several states. Because those states rightly don't want people endangering themselves by trying to take a selfie with a tiger or endangering the animals as well. Apparently, this has to do with online dating culture and the fact that any old selfie of you and or selfie of you and your dog or cat is not sufficient. If you're a guy on Tinder, apparently having a selfie with a tiger is a thing and may get you more interest than you would otherwise garner. So much so that the state of New York actually outright banned these kinds of photos. Yes.
What? so many questions with this. First of all, who's going to be writing the, you know, graduate paper about Tinder's massive effects on, you know, wildlife endangerment? But how and in what circumstances can you be in New York and manage to get a selfie with a tiger such that it's so important that they need to draft legislation to prevent that from happening?
It was aimed at things like circuses. So that, I guess,
is that a thing? Can you go to a circus and just say like, "Hey, I want to pose with your tiger"?
apparently, it wasn't.
Circuses were still a thing.
Well, yeah, they're not, right? Yeah, the legislation in New York only prevents direct contact between members of the public and tigers, and declares that the purpose of this bill is to protect animal caretakers, those interacting with wild animals, bystanders, and the animals themselves, rather than preventing any amorous encounters with them, writes the Independent UK. Tiger selfies apparently are such a thing that they've had to be outlawed in New York. So, Andrew, your dream of being tranquilized by the tigers and having selfies taken with you, apparently the tigers thought that they would look better on Tinder in your company, in your dream. So interesting. And thank you for Scott Robinson for sharing that with us. Let's see. Let's go to our tip of the week. That is that drone regulations continue to proliferate, even though we haven't talked about them in a while here on This Week in Law. The FAA announced this week that it has restricted drone use over several U.S. national landmarks, including the Statue of Liberty. So even though the drone races that I went to a while back were held on Governor's Island, looking across at the Statue of Liberty, if you had flown across and flown over the statue under the current law, you would have been in trouble. And there are a number of other national landmarks that you can't fly over, including the Hoover Dam, the Glen Canyon Dam, various dams. What else? Mount Rushmore, Shasta Lake. Shasta Lake is just the location of the Shasta Dam. Presumably you can still fly over Lake Shasta itself here in California. So just be aware when you're out there droning around that you can't fly just everywhere. Our resources of the week are, we've got a couple of them for you. In fact, it is right now 1 o'clock Pacific time. And if you want to catch the last bit of the Slants performing in Southern California, they have been performing for the last hour at Loyola Law School. I don't know that they have been performing music for the last hour, but there's a event at Loyola Law School where they will be performing if they have not already. Also, a discussion with a number of the professors there about the First Amendment and disparaging trademarks. So that's going on right now and has an hour left if you're in Southern California and can rush to Loyola to go enjoy the Slants. Matt just enjoyed them over at Notre Dame, and hopefully we'll be back next week to tell us even more about that. One last resource for you that was just so wonderful when I encountered it. So happy to have found that someone has mashed up meticulously and with great attention to detail every lyric and every note of music in Hamilton, the musical. And they have created something called Hamilton. Let's see, let me get the title exactly right. An equestrian musical rather than American musical. And they have mashed up Hamilton with clips from My Little Pony. You have to see some of this. It's amazing.
Now, everyone, give it up for the maid of honor, Angelica Schuyler.
A toast to the groom.
To the groom. To the groom. To the groom.
To the bride.
To the bride.
To the bride.
Worth a watch.
Wow.
Seriously, I am just staggered and humbled and amazed and look around at how lucky you are to be alive right now. That you are in a world where Hamilton the Equestrian Musical exists. This comes from Tangerine Blast on YouTube. And it's not so just good. This one song, it's the entire Hamilton musical. And I think you get an idea from just this little bit that we've showed you that the clip selection and syncing up is just impeccably done. I just think I've said enough about that.
I've got one more thing.
Yes.
Not on the Hamilton Equestrian, but just another tip of the week. Next week on Wednesday and Thursday, October 10th and 11th, is the ABA IP West Conference. It's going to be held in Long Beach, California at the Hilton Long Beach Hotel. And I'll be on one of the panels on October 11th, along with a couple other Internet Law and Policy Foundry folks to talk about navigating disruptive technology in the law. So if you want to come out and hear folks talking about AR and VR and health tech and Internet of Things and AI and machine learning, I think it's going to be a really fun discussion and panel, and we'd love to see you there. So that'll
Gabby,
be cool.
Gabby Ziccarelli is one of your co-speakers,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yep.
she was on recently. She plugged it too. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that you brought that up. Yep. Hopefully people can go. Later on this fall in early November, there's another, California bar IP law section that, is going to take place here right in Newport Beach where I am. So you might want to mark your calendars for that 2. Unfortunately, Eric Goldman is going to be speaking there. Unfortunately, he's speaking when we record the show that Friday. So otherwise, I would totally be there and participating. So we are going to have Professor Goldman on the show again soon. I'm not looking at the calendar, so I'm not sure exactly when, but he's coming up. So hopefully you can join us for that. We do record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. We hope you can join us live. If you do, it's great to be able to jump into chat with us. Burke in chat was just letting me know that Andrew Main, whose tweet we featured, is a magician. I think that's who Burke is referring to. So if you're interested in seeing more from Andrew Main, who was on Twit at one point or another, then check out his magic as well. Join us in chat. Let us know things that you know we'd like to know when we're doing the show. Or if you can't, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill and you'll find our entire archive of shows for your consumption at your leisure and on your device of choice. We're very happy to make that available for you. And we're very happy that you can and do join us here on the show. Tell your friends, write us reviews on the various platforms that you enjoy the show on, be it YouTube or iTunes or what have you. Love to get your feedback on the shows. We'd love to get it directly from you as well. You can email us. I am Denise at twit.tv. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Let us know what's on your mind. Folks you think we should invite on the show. Things that you've seen that have made you think of copyright or trademark or privacy or other kinds of legal concerns that we discussed here on the show. You guys are wonderful information getters for us, and your brains work the way that ours do. You see those issues that maybe the average person would not. So we love hearing from you on all those fronts. You can also find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handles have been up throughout the show, but just in case you're doing the audio only, I'm D. Howell there. Mike is J. Michael Keys, all one word, and Emery is Emery Roan, all one word. And the show has a Facebook page as well. You can head on over there and give us your thoughts. We also use that during the week to put up stories that we are thinking about discussing, and that's a great place too for you to post up stories that you think we should be discussing. Another great way to do that is to get involved in the Flipboard magazine that I keep for the show at my D. Howell account on Flipboard. The magazine is logically enough called This Week in Law. And if you want to be a contributor there, just shoot me an email and I'll send you the link so that you can add things to that magazine and we'll think about putting them on the show. Otherwise, we just hope you'll join us and continue to join us. It's been a great time being with you here this week. Mike, so great to see you as always.
That was a lot of fun. Great to see you all.
Yes. Now I'm sure everyone's going to run off and listen to the rest of Hamilton and Equestrian Musical and kill the rest of their Friday afternoon that way. I know that I'm tempted to do so. Emery, that'll help you kill some time as you're waiting for bar results, I hope.
Yeah, and of course, I haven't been able to actually see the musical, so I've been holding off on listening to it. Maybe I'll just watch the My Little Pony remix.
I have not consulted with Lin-Manuel Miranda on this, but I've got to think that he
seems like he'd be pretty chill with it.
Wishes he had done it with ponies in the first place, I'm guessing. Because it works so well.
It's hard to get them up on stage.
Yeah, the costuming's not quite the same either.
How does a horse wear pants? Didn't we deal with this last year?
Yep, it's an issue.
Anyways, thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to see you again, Emery. Great to see all of you again, too. And we hope to see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.